It's Thursday, and that means it's time for Perspectives on WFSU-FM. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Tom Flanagan, and the number for you to provide your input telephonically is 414-1234-LOCAL. Long distance to Tallahassee, 800-926-8809, and perspectives@WFSU.org is, of course, the email address. You know, in the state of Florida, it's relatively tough to become a member of the Florida Supreme Court. There's a very rigorous vetting process for prospective justices. But once on the court, justices have only to obtain a majority vote of confidence from the electorate every 6 years in order to keep the job. Now, that's called merit retention. And three Florida Supreme Court justices, Fred Lewis, Barbara Perriente, and Peggy Quince, will be on the ballot for merit retention this year. Now, usually such things are relatively uncontroversial and somewhat low-key. Not the case this year. We're not going to get into that a lot, but we will acknowledge that there is some discussion, some high-level discussion about the ins and outs of merit retention. So we thought it would be highly appropriate to bring on some folks who can speak to that and also give us some real insights into how the judicial process works in the state of Florida, because it is a mystery to so many of us, even people who cover these things on a regular basis. So we welcome first to Perspectives this morning the current, soon to be immediate past president of the Florida Bar, Scott Hawkins. Thanks so much for coming in, Scott.
Thank you very much, Tom. Thanks for having us.
We also say hello to Gwen Young, who is about to take over the reins of the Florida Bar for the upcoming – the 64th president, I believe, isn't it, Gwen?
That's correct. And next week I'll be it. And we certainly appreciate your giving us the opportunity to be here, Tom.
Well, before we get started on that big, big meeting, as you had indicated before we went on the air, Scott, for members of the Florida Bar statewide that will be taking place next year, the annual convention going on, at which time the transfer of power takes place. But what are some of the things that are going to be happening in the course of that gathering?
Well, the Florida Bar Convention has been conducted for over 60 years, and this year we have one of the largest conventions ever scheduled. A whole host of programming has been set up for the convention. One of the lead programs, though, that I want to bring attention to relates to our program this morning, and that is we are conducting a symposium next Friday where we're going to be featuring retired Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, along with a very distinguished panel. And that symposium will be devoted to the topic of judicial merit retention across the country as well as in Florida. In addition to that program, a number of educational programs will be conducted in various types of subject matter, as well as a number of programs involving ongoing bar efforts like the trial lawyer section, the real property section, the administrative law section, government law section. They'll all be convening on an annual, as they do annually, to talk about things important within those subsections of the Florida Bar.
Okay. A little bit of historical background. For a short period of time, I lived in the state of Texas, where you elect just about everything that moves. There's very little in the way of appointment or a process that does not involve direct election. Here in Florida, though, it's a little bit different. And either you, Scott, or Gwen, how did we get to the point where we have this rather involved scenario of becoming a Supreme Court justice, and then we go into the merit retention every 6 years? How long have we been doing that?
Well, I know Gwen's going to have some comments on this, but let me give you some brief historical perspective. Since 1976, so that's roughly – it's almost 40 years, the system for selecting justices of the Florida Supreme Court and for selecting appellate judges of the state appellate court has been through the system of merit selection and merit retention. Basically, what that means is in 1976, Floridians amended the Florida Constitution, which is a major fact. It's difficult to amend the most important fundamental doctrine or document, legal doctrine in our state, but voters overwhelmingly passed this amendment to put in place the system of selecting appellate judges and justices through nonpartisan judicial nominating commissions based on merit. And then after they have served 6 years generally, they are subject to a merit retention vote, which again is to be nonpartisan and is to be based on merit. And the question for the voters is whether the service of Judge or Justice so-and-so merits their retaining their office and continuing in judicial office for another six-year term. The system in Florida has gone through many changes since the 1800s when our first Constitution was written. At times, justices were directly elected by voters. In fact, the system that immediately predated the constitutional amendment passing in 1976 allowed for justices of the Florida Supreme Court to be voted, elected through general elections. And there were a number of problems that plagued the high court in the late 60s and 70s. A number of very scandalous activities that occurred that caused the court to fall in great disrespect nationally and within the state. And that was the backdrop that led Governors Askew and then Governor Graham to implement the system we have today, which was adopted by the citizens of Florida in amending the Constitution. I'm sure Gwen's got some comments as well.
I really think that looking at the history of how this came about is something that the Florida citizens should be aware of, because this happened so long ago. There are a lot of people who weren't alive, you know, when all of this occurred. And I think some of it actually started with Governor Kirk. And we had three Supreme Court justices who were facing criminal investigation and also investigations by the Judicial Qualifications Commission for some of their activities. You know, an example of things that they would do is because of the campaign contributions and people who had been supporters, one Supreme Court justice received a brief on the golf course, which he then, circulated. It was from someone involving a case pending before the court, and he circulated it to the court, which clearly he was not supposed to do. And there were also examples of the higher court trying to influence opinions of the lower courts, to help people who had made donations or who had supported them in the campaign. And because of this, people, went forward and really looked at putting in place a system that took politics out of this selection process. And I think Governor Kirk and then Governor Askew are really to be commended, because Governor Askew actually implemented this merit selection system before it was required, and gave up power that he had as governor to select these judges, and started using a merit selection screening process with a nominating commission, I think in 1972, which was 4 years before the Constitution put it in place. And as Scott said, the system has worked well now for for over 30 years, and hopefully the process will work as it should this fall.
I believe that wasn't there a kind of authoritative documentation of some of the shenanigans pre-change? I think it was called, a Most Dishonorable Court? That was the Martin Dykeman book that came out documenting some of that stuff.
That's exactly right.
Absolutely. And I would encourage anyone who's interested to read it, because it reads like a novel.
What about the folks, though, who contend, well, doggone, since the Supreme Court justices are going to be deciding some very significant elements of public policy, they should have the input of the people in deciding who should sit on the high court? That argument still keeps coming up despite the constitutional situation we have now.
That's right, and that's an argument that will, I think, be forever a part of American political speech. Importantly, though, when you assess the system in Florida, and the system in Florida is reflective of, I think, at least 24 other states in the nation that have a similar merit retention system, Supreme Court justices, through the merit retention election, which cycles back every 6 years, they are accountable. And so voters do have an opportunity to influence or to be heard, if you will, with regard to the service of justices on the Supreme Court. So our system accounts for the role of the voter in that mechanism. It's interesting. I just finished a study of this whole topic, but the genesis of this plan comes from work that was done by a law professor at the University of Northwestern in 1913 who was trying to arrive at a plan to depoliticize the court system. And that's where this hybrid came up of merit selection and then merit retention voting. And it's been adopted widely across the nation. And where it's been adopted, it's never been overturned as a system. There have been efforts to overturn it in other states, but it's never been overturned. That tells you that, you know, by and large, voters appreciate that the system has been depoliticized through these efforts of merit selection through nonpartisan commissions and then merit retention through nonpartisan votes.
But whereas with the Judicial Nominating Commission, you have some very esteemed, learned folks who can get into the niceties of someone's legal background and how they ruled on different kinds of cases and what their background was and all that, and really get into the nuts and bolts of a particular person's qualifications. And then 6 years later, the average voter who may not have access to the same kind of information will be asked to decide, should they stay or should they go? It doesn't that make it for a different kind of level of scrutiny?
Yes, but I think it also demonstrates the way the system is intended to work. And I know Gwen's got views on this very strongly, but our system is set up such that you have very qualified people get appointed to serve on the judicial nominating commissions for each district court, each circuit court, and the Supreme Court. And then people apply for the offices of judge, and they go through an extremely rigorous vetting process. These commissions are nonpartisan. Political party affiliation is not part of the process. The process is all about merit. Does the record of the applicant merit retention? If they make it through the process and get nominated to the governor, and then make it through that effort and get appointed, there's been a strong effort to determine whether the backgrounds of these persons and their abilities and competencies merit their being appointed as a judge. Presumably, after 6 years of service, absent some serious ethical issue, which occurs infrequently but does occur, the presumed merit when they were selected should attach to their retention. So that's the way the system was intended to work.
So if they kind of jump through the hoop the first time, there is a good chance that they probably are at least minimally qualified for the job. We'll talk more about it in just a moment. The complex and some might even infer arcane subject of merit retention, but an important one when it comes to our judiciary here in the state of Florida, because even if you have never had a dealing with a judge, say, whether it's a traffic case or a misdemeanor or a civil suit or something like that, the functioning of the judiciary is absolutely critical to the ongoing governance of this state. It's just that it's almost like a stealth situation. It's not readily apparent. And so that's why we're talking today with Scott Hawkins, the president of the Florida Bar, and incoming president as of next week, Gwen Young, to address the whole issue of merit retention. And Gwen, you wanted to say something about the fact that, again, folks are – you go through this big process to get into being judges and justices, and then it's up to the electorate, who may not be quite as savvy about this stuff, to decide whether or not they stay every 6 years.
All right. Well, I wanted to comment on something that Scott had said previously, and that is, if the merit selection process works as it should, then you should select quality candidates, and you wouldn't expect those people to have issues with the performance of their job during the 6 years that they serve before they face a merit retention election. This is the one circumstance where, unlike political candidates, you really wouldn't expect to know the name of a judge or justice. In fact, often if you do know their name, it may be because something has occurred to put their name in the press, and often that isn't something positive. So it's probably the one place where not having name recognition is a good thing. It's a very, very difficult process to say how do you decide about merit retention. And that's what we're trying to do through this merit retention education program that we have, to try to talk with people about where you can go for information, where you can learn about the role of a judge, and hopefully provide information helpful to making your vote.
But the Florida Bar, in and of its nature, and you folks are connected to the Supreme Court, is not like you are a child of the Supremes, or there's some kind of relationship there, isn't there?
The Florida Bar was established by the Supreme Court to regulate lawyers and to oversee licensure.
Okay, so in that regard, you folks would not take an advocacy position one way or another when it comes to determining the outcome of a merit retention situation, right?
No, that's 100% right. We do not. We're nonpartisan. This program of ours is about public voter education, and our objective is to enhance voter understanding. I want to go back to your point. You used the phrase, I think it was arcane and difficult to comprehend. The Florida Bar conducted research regarding the whole topic of merit retention, and our research, which was conducted through focus groups conducted around the state, indicates that 90% of those who participated in the focus group research did not have an understanding of judicial merit retention, did not understand what judicial merit retention is about, what its purpose is, how it operates, what the role of the vote is, in fact. With that research, the Florida Bar, through the Board of Governors, so a 52-member body from around the state, elected by bar members, with two lay members, I should add, who are non-lawyers who sit on that body, decided to initiate the Votes in Your Court program, voter program, to enhance voter education on this extremely important vote, which will occur in November 2012, where there will be 15 appellate judges on Florida's highest appellate court and three Supreme Court justices up for retention. It's a very, very significant effort in our exercise, in our democracy, and we were concerned about the 90% knowledge gap that we learned through the focus group research.
Let's go to the phones here. By the way, 414-1234 is the number to call for Perspectives as we talk with Scott Hawkins and Gwen Young, both of the Florida Bar, about the merit retention issue, 800-926-8809, long distance. Eric is close distance, so he's right here in Tallahassee. Hi, Eric. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I think I would challenge the notion that it is a nonpartisan and very equal nomination process because, as you said, it is the Florida Lawyers Association that's picking these individuals, and that association, like most lawyers, is very heavily tilted to the left. And my understanding is the one gentleman who picks the actual panel, who selects these individuals, was the same well-known partisan who led the case to overthrow the 2000 election in the Bush-Gore election. So in essence, you had the very gentleman who was in charge of selecting all those judges in the Supreme Court filing suit against the state. And not surprisingly, the Supreme Court all unanimously voted to interfere in that election. They were all slapped down at the Supreme Court level on the federal level, but that should give you some indication of how far out of the mainstream they were. Not a single dissenter was in that case on the Florida Supreme Court, and yet they lost significantly on the federal level. So anyone who believes that the trial lawyers is a moderate mainstream organization equally representing Republicans as well as Democrats is living in a fantasy land. The whole thing is stacked against supporting Republicans and certainly not conservatives, and the results of the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, are very clear in that regard. Just look at all the laws that they look at before they're even put on the ballot and they strike down. Across the board, it's always ones that favor Republican causes. They say, well, it doesn't cite this, it doesn't cite that. But if it's a proposal to limit class sizes or something like that, then they don't have any problem with it. So this is very disingenuous statements coming from this group here, I believe.
Okay, Eric, thanks for the input on that. There always seems to be this yin and yang, though, that there is a perception that politics reigns supreme no matter what organization you're talking about. If I am a Democrat, I am going to have a Democrat way of looking at the world. If I am a Republican, I will have a Republican way, and that also holds true in the judiciary, just the way it does on the floor of the Florida House of Representatives or in the governor's mansion or any place else. And what is the actual function, though, of the judiciary when it comes to deciding these things? To get as many Democrats on a particular group of judges as possible, or Republicans? Or how do you balance all of that out, the political considerations and the judicial considerations?
Well, I will comment first by saying I want to make it clear the Florida Bar is not the Trial Lawyers Association. The Florida Bar represents a broad spectrum of lawyers. I'm a business lawyer. Gwen is a business lawyer. We work a lot with real property issues, trust issues. On the Board of Governors, which is the 52-member ruling body, we probably have over 60% would be considered business lawyers, not lawyers who are involved in tort-related matters. And I don't know this for sure, but I would think party affiliation on the Florida Bar, Board of Governors, would be close to 50-50 between the two parties. With regard – so I think that's important in terms of appreciating that, you know, this is truly not partisan. This is about the quality of voter understanding the role of the judiciary and the function of the courts. I want to say, you know, the sense that I've had from being – working with the bar for many, many years is that it's – a lot of voters don't have a ready appreciation. If they haven't been through litigation, they don't have a ready appreciation for what a trial judge does day in and day out. They don't understand that trial judge's role is largely to determine whether or not presented evidence comes into evidence, whether or not truly the facts should be trusted and allowed into evidence, and how the law applies to the facts. A lot of what a trial judge does is oversees and regulates how a trial is conducted and regulates what questions are asked of witnesses, what arguments are made to before the court and to the jury, and basically create the appellate record. In the appellate context, appellate judges like on the 50CA or appellate judges at the Supreme Court, they look at what's in the record and they look at the issues that have been preserved on appeal. They are confined to making their decisions by and large to what's in the appellate record. These are complicated concepts to explain. The role being, though, that a judge's role is very confined to the issues presented in a court and the issues presented on appeal. And but I will say it's clear to me that the average person in our culture expects to have a judge who will be fair and impartial and able. By able, I mean able to decipher the information and to decipher the facts and apply the law to the facts. So in the end of the day, the expectation in American culture, in our court system, is you're going to get a fair and independent judge to rule on your case. And that's what this whole exercise is about. Do the efforts of these judges demonstrate a record of independence, impartiality, the ability to rule, putting personal views aside?
Okay. Clarification. Who sits on the Judicial Nominating Commission?
Well, you know, if you look at who sits on the Judicial Nominating Commissions, they're basically there's a process for people going onto the nominating commissions. There are four seats on the nominating commission out of nine seats that come from individuals who make application to the bar for appointment to one of those seats. The bar then evaluates the applications and sends up three names from those applicants for each seat to the governor's office, and then the governor makes the appointment from those three names to fill a particular seat. So the ultimate choice is the governor's, but we, the bar, screen applications and make recommendations. The governor has the right to reject a slate and ask the bar to send an additional slate. That happens rarely, but it has happened. The other five seats are appointed by the governor, and the governor's office solicits applications and makes appointments. So it's a totally appointive process. The ultimate person who makes the appointments is the governor. It's not the bar. The bar's role is screening applicants and submitting names for the four seats that the bar takes applications for to the governor.
Yeah, because I think what Eric was articulating, I'd kind of heard this from a number of other sources too, that the whole idea is if you have a Democrat as a governor, then there will be liberal judges that will come into the Supreme Court or the courts of appeal or whatever. If it's a Republican governor, then it will be all Republicans and more conservative in their viewpoint. And the whole idea is to get as many of your guys, depending on who you are, as possible into those positions, thereby making it a political kind of process.
Well, you know, I honestly don't believe that is the case. I think that the issue of having a 9-person screening committee, you know, is to provide a diverse group of people, and we look for people from different practice areas. You know, we look for, you know, different backgrounds to come up with a nominating committee that can screen and make recommendations from 3 to 6 people to the governor, who then selects, you know, from those individuals the person that he or she would appoint to that position. I've served on a nominating commission previously, and I know the JNC that I served on, which was the second DCA JNC. You know, what we did was look at who we thought was best qualified for the job, you know, based on our interviews, our background. We'd call their, you know, references. We'd look at their applications, and we would make a decision and make recommendations to the governor, who then made the appointments. I think it is probably realistic that any governor looks at individuals and is probably more likely to want to appoint someone that is more akin to that governor's view of things, but he's got to do that from the pool of candidates that are submitted to him by the nominating commission.
And in the case, I believe it was Governor Crist, didn't he reject one of the suggestions of the Judicial Nominating Commission because he said, oh, it was not diverse enough and he wanted another group to pick from?
He may have done that. I know that Governor Scott has done that, you know, I think on at least 2 occasions with those commissions. But I think it's also important to recognize something that Scott touched on earlier, which is in the role of the judge, you know, the judge's job is to set aside personal views, to look at the record for an appellate judge, you know, that person needs to make a decision on, and to apply the law to the facts that have been established by that record to make that decision. And same with a trial judge. You know, as a trier of fact, you're looking at law as it's applied to the set of facts that have been put into evidence. And that process is really what a judge does.
And I think that was maybe another factor that came out here. If I'm in a criminal or a civil court case and the judge rules against me, I'm not going to like it at all, one little bit. And by the same token, those folks who say, well, through the will of the people expressed by the legislature, these constitutional amendments or whatever else are passed, and then these judges come back and they overturn the will of the people. Well, that means we get mad at them, right? What is actually the function, though, of the Florida Supreme Court when it comes to dealing with these kinds of issues that come before them? Will this or will this not make it to the ballot? Does this meet judicial and legal scrutiny?
Well, the role of the Florida Supreme Court is the court of last resort in the state of Florida for deciding issues within the jurisdiction of the Florida Supreme Court as defined by the rules of the court. In the issue – in connection with legislation, if there has been a challenge that proposed legislation or pending legislation is deemed to be unconstitutional and that's found to be the case in the lower court, then there would be an appeal and it would make its way up to the Supreme Court potentially. you know, in the course of my career, challenging a statute perhaps has happened less than three or four times. And I've been practicing law for 27 years and have been involved in many, many litigated matters and many, many constitutional issues. The point being, though, if it comes to the court, the issue presented to the court is whether the proposed legislation or the legislation under challenge is unconstitutional. And there are a lot of considerations that go into that. But that's the job of the court. Mr. Jefferson and Mr. Madison, when they set up the three-branch system of government as reflected in the U.S. Constitution and the Florida Constitution, they gave the court in part the responsibility for ruling on questions of whether a statute or a piece of legislation was unconstitutional. And if it isn't, it's the job of the court, it's the role of the court to strike legislation down as being unconstitutional. And remember, this court is composed of seven persons from around the state. To find a piece of legislation unconstitutional, four persons at least have to so find. It's not one person, it's four. And that's in essence a system of checks and balances all the way up the line. But that's the role of the court. That's what they're asked to do. And that's one of the functions of the Supreme Court.
And conceivably, you could replace those members of the Supreme Court that you believe are in the wrong with folks that you think might be more amenable to your point of view and get the same result.
Well, there's a lot of historical evidence that presidents expected a justice to be of a certain nature and turned out to be of the opposite nature, to your point.
We'll be right back on Perspectives, talking with Scott Hawkins and Gwynne Young, incoming and outgoing presidents of the Florida Bar, about merit retention. And we welcome your input to 414-1234, 800-926-8809. Boy, we are just going to have one gollywampin' ballot to contend with when we get into the voting booth come November, because we have the, of course, presidential election, and we have other federal offices, and we have local offices to contend with, and we also have to look at merit retention for three members of the Florida Supreme Court: Fred Lewis, Barbara Perriente, and Peggy Quince. They are up for the merit retention, which we're talking about today on Perspectives with Scott Hawkins and Gwynne Young with the Florida Bar. And we were talking just off air for a second ago, the popularity, or should the judiciary kind of look at public opinion before they make a ruling? Oh, here's something that came before us, and now what do the voters think? And maybe that should influence how we rule on a particular case. That isn't the role of the judiciary, right? Right, Gwynne?
Absolutely not. The judiciary is not supposed to do what's popular. They're supposed to look at what the law is and make a decision based on what the law says applied to the facts. And oftentimes that isn't something popular. You know, we have many examples of things that have been done by the courts which weren't popular, but which, you know, was what was done by applying the law to a fact. The example that we were discussing off the record was the decision of Brown versus Board of Education, which was the decision that essentially said separate but equal was not what the Constitution provided for, and that therefore we shouldn't have separate school systems for blacks and for whites. And that was not a popular decision, but it was what the justices believed the law required, and they made that unpopular decision by applying the law to the facts.
And maybe that's where that whole activist judge argument comes in, because in that instance, and in many others certainly, a high court has ruled against the will of the people, and in the case of Brown versus Board of Education in several states where that was the way that the legislature, expressing the will of the people in that state, had set up a segregated type of system. And the U.S. Supreme Court came in and said, no, this isn't right. You can't do that.
Yeah, and it's interesting. That case has really provoked a lot of scholarly legal writing, but from a variety of different places. You know, for example, Robert Bork, in his book The Tempting of America, essentially said that he would have decided that case exactly the way the court did, even though many people said that court was an activist court. He would have just decided it differently. And I think that's is an important issue in understanding what happens with a legal decision. You have a set of facts. You have a body of law, and different judges look at that law in different ways and may still reach the same decision as to what is the right result applying that law to the facts.
Gee, sometimes it makes me wonder, wouldn't it be a lot easier if some of these statutes were written better the first go around, and so we didn't have to bring in the judiciary as often to interpret, to infer? Now, gosh, what did the lawmakers really mean by that, and does it comport with the Constitution? I mean, there's an awful lot of stuff that comes out, not just Florida legislature, Congress and other state legislatures, stuff that's impenetrable to the average person or even the best legal mind, and you have to parse it through this whole judiciary.
That is from time to time an issue that the high court, whether it be the U.S. Supreme Court or the Florida Supreme Court, determines is a problem with a piece of legislation, that it's ambiguous or the title is vague and doesn't meet constitutional standards.
How do we find out about the justices who are up for merit retention right now, since they can't go out and fill the airwaves with all kinds of, hi, I'm Fred Lewis, I'm a good guy, you should vote to keep me in office? There are strictures, there are legal things in place that really prevent that sort of thing from happening. So if they can't go to the people through the popular media, how do we find out about these folks?
Well, the Florida Bar has engaged in an effort to assemble information regarding the various judicial candidates who will be on the November ballot. And again, it consists of 15 appellate judges and 3 Supreme Court justices, and we've attempted to gather basic neutral information about each judge and justice on the ballot to make that available to folks who want to access the Florida Bar website. We will have a web page devoted to this issue where there'll be this information available. The Florida League of Women Voters will have information available as a source. We have collaborated with them somewhat in terms of trying to make our information available through them and so forth. The Florida Bar has been involved in these efforts before, and this effort today is a further extension of our commitment to trying to enhance voter education and awareness of this important vote. I want to come back to a point Gwen made a moment ago at the very beginning of the program about the whole issue of the vote. You know, in American culture, when you have someone running for representative office, let's say hypothetically you're running for Congress, your objective is to get name recognition. And voters in our culture are conditioned to vote for names they recognize. And they are also conditioned to try to attribute a favorable policy position to your name, and that will motivate them to vote. That is a very different paradigm than what you're looking at with regard to someone running for retention on the Supreme Court or running for retention on the second DCA, for example. Judges aren't able to talk about their policy views because the Code of Judicial Ethics prohibits that. They're not able to campaign broadly about how they may rule or how they may decide. And the reason is that the Code of Judicial Ethics prohibits that. And why is that? That is in part because we expect judges – our system is grounded on judges being fair, impartial, independent, able to put their personal views aside when they rule on a matter, whether it's at the trial court level or at the state court of appeal. And the Code of Ethics prohibits that type of campaigning. So why am I telling you this? I think it's important to appreciate that a vote for a justice or a vote for a judge – It's a very different assessment exercise than voting for someone running for the state house, for the state senate, or Congress, because name recognition is a completely different issue. Our system prohibits justices and judges from broadly disseminating their names. It's just not part of the natural role. But yet voters are asked to function on this every time these candidates come up for retention. It's an interesting incongruency in our system.
That is. And by the same token, and if you really want to find out how particularly on the Supreme Court side, although the District Court of Appeals have this too. You can go back, it's available online, and check all the rulings. How did a particular judge or justice rule in a multitude of cases? And you can get a good track record there. It may take you a while because there's a lot of information and some of those rulings are quite lengthy, but you can get some – at least an idea of someone's thinking process when you read through some of those rulings.
Well, and I think that data shows that during any six-year period, a justice will have touched, you know, maybe 2,500 a year in matters. And so they touch a lot of matters, and so trying to go in and figure out, you know, a justice's performance by looking at each and every opinion might be difficult, but you're absolutely right. It could be done.
Yeah, and you can look at them like, well, I like that one. I didn't like that one. I like that one. Oh, there's another one I didn't like. And that may not be the best way to assess the performance of someone on the judiciary either.
And your question really goes to a very interesting point, and that is when you're asked as a voter to assess the merit of Justice Flanagan, to use your name for example, do you assess Justice Flanagan based on one ruling in a six-year term or two rulings, or do you base it upon your body of work over that period of time? It's a complicated issue.
Yeah, let's go back to the phones here. Tony is in Tallahassee. He wants to talk about the Constitution. Hi, Tony.
Hey, good morning. Wanted to ask, after listening a little while and very interesting conversation, was wondering whether or not, first of all, because of what it appears your goal is to educate, and then suggest perhaps that maybe legislation needs to be changed to correct this or correct that. The only viable way to get some level of change, particularly within the judicial system, is through constitutional amendment. And of course, we Floridians know how popular constitutional amendments are. And I was wondering what notion each of your guests would have on the issue of constitutional amendments as it relates to matters relating to the judiciary system in terms of improvement. I know that's not why they're here today, but would like to get a perspective on that, and I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. And I imagine if Tony might be referring to a constitutional amendment that would change again the way that judges or justices are selected through the judicial nominating process, or what other constitutional matters are targeting the judiciary in that way?
Well, I will make this observation. The process of the formation of a constitutional amendment starts principally in the legislative body. And then when it goes through that process, it then has to go on the ballot, and voters have to decide whether or not to amend the Florida Constitution up or down. In that process, thereafter, the court would have a role if there's a challenge on whether that proposed legislation, before it goes on the ballot or after, is deemed to be unconstitutional. That process essentially involves every branch of government and the voters. And I think that's what the framers of the Constitution of the United States exactly intended, that in essence, you've got the legislative branch, you got the voters, you got the judicial branch all playing a role in terms of whether the constitutional document issue should be amended. So it's in essence a form of checks and balances. When we talk about the votes in your court, our focus is on public education of voters with regard to this very important exercise of voting on very important constitutional officers in our country, in our state, judges, appellate judges and justices. We're not focusing in this program on legislation. But it's the court's role to rule on whether a proposed amendment is constitutional. That's their role. And that's the way the framers intended it. I think I'm comfortable with that.
I think what I would add, going toward this, I think the Florida Bar has from the outset been a strong supporter of the merit selection and merit retention system of both choosing our judges and then making a decision on the retention of justices. And I think we continue to support merit selection and retention of judges, and we continue to strongly support the bar having a role in the selection of judges, because we believe lawyers, you know, are in a unique position to evaluate candidates, you know, for the judiciary. So I don't think, you know, as Scott has discussed the process, that, you know, we, the bar, see that we have a system that's broke, that we would be, you know, seeking to change in any way. What we're seeking to do is to try to educate people about the process, to try to give people the tools to show them where they can look for information to be able to evaluate these judges, and then hopefully encourage them to go out and vote in November. I think one of the things we're looking toward is the fact that because so few people know the people who are up for retention, you often see a huge drop-off in the number of people who vote on the candidates for judicial merit retention. We're hoping that through this education process, we get more people to take that opportunity to vote, and I think that's where we're focused.
Yeah, but as you pointed out, both of you, it does make it rough because the natural instinct and the legal mechanism that surrounds the judiciary makes it so hard for these folks to get out, to become known, and for however they have performed their duties, for that to become common knowledge, because you just don't have the same kind of promotional devices available to them as you do for everyone else in politics.
And just to focus in on that, a justice who is running for retention, that justice can't explain how he or she decided to be in the majority on whatever view. That's not permitted in our discussion. Unlike someone running for Congress who may be challenged on a vote they cast on, you know, strong defense or taxation, where that candidate can explain their position. In the world of judicial decision making, a justice is not permitted to explain their view. So that's your question demonstrates how difficult this exercise is. And the code of judicial ethics prohibits them from doing that.
Yeah, and how critical our vote is, because we decide this, you know, with the small amount of information that we have available. And as you said, Gwen, the level of participation drops off because a lot of folks go, I don't know anything about this. And they just go on to something they do know something about because they've seen 18,000 TV ads about it.
I think that you know, that's true. And hopefully we can get more information out there this year to help people make this decision. One thing that we haven't mentioned but that will be accessible through the bar's website and will be publicized, the bar does do a judicial poll, you know, of all justices and judges up for retention each year, and they send it out to all lawyers in Florida and ask them to say whether they would vote to retain or not retain the justices, and the results of those polls are made available. And that's one other tool that we've done, I think, virtually every year since these retention elections began to be held.
Sort of like a peer review, it sounds
exactly.
Like. Yeah.
Importantly, that data, that poll is based on information from folks who've actually worked in those courts and appeared before those judges and justices. And we're asking those informed participants to provide that information for the benefit of the public. I will say that in my travels and speaking on this topic, I have tons of lawyers and, you know, leaders in the communities come to me and say every time this election rolls up, I have people call me to say, we don't know who these people are, these justices or these judges. How do we decide who to vote for and how to vote for them? And that demonstrates, you know, the difficulty in assessing, you know, judicial merit and assessing how to vote. It demonstrates the lack of understanding that we talked about a few minutes ago.
Well, we certainly want to refer folks to the Florida Bar website for more information, since it is available, and also the League of Women Voters, too. They'll be involved in this as well. What is the Florida Bar website that folks can get onto, Quinn?
It's www.flabar.org.
FLABar.org. Folks, really appreciate it to Scott Hawkins, the present and soon to be immediate past president of the Florida Bar. Thank you so much for coming in. And Madam President Gwen Young, I hope you have a wonderful term coming up and a very productive get-together as the Florida Bar holds its convention next week. Thanks for illuminating
us on
this.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Really appreciate it, folks. Perspectives produced by WFSU-FM and Tallahassee. Technical assistance provided by Taylor Cox, Michael Fleming on the phones and emails today. I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week. More expert opinion and, of course, your input right here on Perspectives.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcasts. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.